Once again, good afternoon, good evening. We are having some technical issues, but we'll continue nonetheless. So I am going to assign to co-hosts so that, you know, hopefully the program will continue. Just give us a second so that, you know, I can try and set up our Facebook stream at least, so we can hopefully continue on Beitar there. We wanted to express our gratitude to all the attendees that are joining us here on Zoom and that are joining us on Facebook in just about a minute, hopefully, so that we can have an informative program ahead. Yes, sir. Okay, once again, thank you for your patience. We will be starting in a minute, inshallah, God willing. I don't know how many, it seems like, you know, we have participants from across the region, not only the Pennsylvania region, but we've been having storms and that has been impacting connectivity. So with that, we will hopefully be starting soon. All right, in the meantime, what I will do is perhaps I'll invite our executive director, Jacob Bender, to say a few words about CARE Philadelphia to all the attendees who are kindly joining us here. Jacob, why don't you go ahead and then maybe do that. And in the meantime, I'm working on the Facebook live stream and it's slowly coming alive, but we may need just another minute.
Jacob, your voice is muted.
CARE is a national organization with 33 chapters around the country. And the organization is approximately 20 years old. The chapters 33 again are spread out all over the United States. I have the honor to being the director here in Philadelphia for the last 7-8 years. CARE is primarily a domestic organization dealing with Islamophobia and discrimination against Muslim Americans. However, on occasion, when we realize that our brothers and sisters are being persecuted, we organize events such as this one, such as next week dealing with Kashmir, and 2 weeks ago we did a webinar on Palestine. So these are some of the activities that we undertake, and we are really glad that both of you are here today to participate in this program. So welcome. Amit, it's all yours.
Thank you, Jacob, for that. What I will suggest doing is, because we have quite a few attendees here on Zoom, with us. What I will suggest is we can get started, and hopefully the once the live stream is set up, our audience there can catch up, and we will of course make the full program through the recording available as well. So I wanted to thank again Jacob and both of our speakers, Rushan Abbas of Campaign for Uyghurs and Elise Anderson from Uyghur Human Rights Project for joining us today. I wanted to also give a shout out and thank Guangxin Ha from Haverford College, with whom and with the Hereford Center at Haverford College, we have been cooperating on a connected project called Contest of the Fruits that centers around an ancient Uyghur text and Uyghur civilization. So Guangxin kindly reconnected me with Elise and with Dr. Rishat Abbas, a local Pennsylvania-based Uyghur American leader. We have been blessed to work and to exchange ideas. We've been able to bring Rushan Abbas, one of the leading voices of Uyghur Americans in the DC, Virginia area, with us today. So what we are looking at is a complex and a long-standing issue. And yet, having said that, I would caution us against making this just an international conflict issue. Sometimes that leads us to dehumanize the subjects, the very individuals that go through and experience hardship through this process. What I wanted us to do is to start off with a section where both of our speakers can briefly introduce themselves and their work, so that our audience, those who may not be familiar with them and their expertise, their backgrounds, can be familiar with that. And then we'll go into a series of questions and answers. And we, of course, invite our audience members to also please post their questions to us and to our speakers here on Zoom. And once the Facebook stream starts. With that, I want to invite Rushan Abbas to kindly take the first step and introduce us a little bit about herself and her trajectory coming into the United States as an Uyghur, Uyghur American here, and her work, and then we'll go to Dr. Elise Anderson.
Thank you so much, Ahmed. Thank you, Jacob, and the CARE Philadelphia for setting up this panel, giving us this opportunity to raise awareness, highlight this active genocide against Uyghur people currently. I started my activism work while I was a student, co-organizing the pro-democracy demonstrations at my university in 1985 and in 1988 in East Turkestan, which is called Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region by the Chinese authorities today. Xinjiang is the name given to our homeland by China, Chinese government, after the occupation. It means new territory, a name which is inaccurate at best and insulting at worst to the Uyghurs. So we refuse to use that. Since my arrival in the United States in 1989, I have advocated for Uyghur rights. And I also co-founded the first Uyghur organization in the US in early 90s, and also helped establish the Uyghur American Association, which is my brother, Dr. Rishad Abbas, is one of the co-founders. And the also a longtime advocate for Uyghur people. I was also privileged to work as the first Uyghur reporter for Radio Free Asia, broadcasting daily to the Uyghur region when the service was initially launched. And I have also worked as a linguist and a translator. And I was honored to be involved in the translating and also resettling of the 22 Uyghurs who were mistakenly in Guantanamo. I can just keep going. I don't know how much to give. Last few years, I founded the Campaign for Uyghurs in 2017 to advocate for the human rights and the democratic freedoms after the situation in East Turkestan deteriorated rapidly with a million people in the concentration camps. Now it went up to more than 3 million. I guess I can talk about the organization in the later.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that, Shannon. Dr. Anderson, Elise, tell us a little bit about your background. You're an academic specializing on Uyghur culture civilization. You have spent many years in the region. So a little bit about yourself and your work.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Thank you. And thank you to you and to all of CARE for inviting me to be part of this panel, for organizing it in the first place. And thanks to all of you out in the ethers who are watching along with us right now. So I am perhaps very obviously to all of you, not Uyghur myself. I was born and raised in Oklahoma in a tiny rural town, actually. And I did not know who Uyghurs were for the first 20 years of my life. But as a college student, as an undergraduate, when I was studying music, I was looking for some reason to keep me away from home for the summer. And I ended up teaching English in Urumqi many, many moons ago. I hated teaching English, if I'm being really frank about it. But I absolutely was fascinated by Uyghurs, by Uyghur culture, by Uyghur music. And I thought, wow, if I get a chance to study Uyghur language and Uyghur music someday, I think I'd really like to do that. And so I just ended up doing it. I went to graduate school at Indiana because it was one of the places, one of the few places in the US where I could start to study the Uyghur language. I learned Uyghur, I learned Chinese. I spent my summers going to the region, to Urumqi, to Kashgar, and learning about Uyghur music, trying to learn the language better. And then I went to do dissertation research for my PhD in 2012 and stayed until the middle of 2016. So I've lived in, you know, a Uyghur community. I was so fortunate and blessed, truly, to be able to live in a Uyghur community for years of my life, studying a form of traditional music called muqam, mostly, but also learning a lot about pop music and culture and life in that place. Upon coming back to the US, you know, I very quickly saw, along with other people who specialize in this region of the world, and along with my Uyghur friends and colleagues, that the situation was deteriorating really rapidly, and in a way that even the most cynical of us did not ever quite expect would happen. And so I've decided, since finishing my PhD, to, you know, move into working in human rights and to working in advocacy, and, you know, not staying silent and saying, okay, how can I contribute to this cause? Can we, as this village that it's going to take to address this problem, like, what can we do and how can I be a part of it? So I still have one foot sort of in academia. I also perform, I translate, and pretty much everything I do is connected to Uyghurs and Uyghur rights, Uyghur music and culture, and, you know, this bigger crisis and village of people who are trying to solve it. So I guess we can turn it back over to talk about our organizations, maybe.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much for that, Elise. And definitely we'll be very interested to hear more about, you know, your research and how that's connected to your work. Yeah, so if you can come back to Rushan Abbas of Campaign for Uyghurs. Rushan Hanım, if you could tell us a little bit about 1989 to today, what has been your work, not only with Campaign for Uyghurs, but other work, and what are some of the differences in terms of the awareness around the Uyghur people in the United States since then?
When I came to United States in 1989, basically there were just a handful of Uyghur people here living in United States. A few families came before that, actually, back in the 60s, 70s, from Turkey or from Pakistan and the other countries. But when I came over after 1979, when China established diplomatic relationship with United States, we were one of the first pioneers to come as students to United States. Me and my brother, we both came in 1989. And then 1990, when Baron Massacre happened, I started my advocacy work here in the United States. And I have been always advocating for the Uyghur people's human rights. As I mentioned, my brother is one of the founding members of the Uyghur American Association and the vice president. I was also elected twice as the vice president of the Uyghur American Association. I never stop doing advocacy work as like at the side, not as a full-time job, but just doing it at the side all these years. But as I mentioned earlier, we founded the Campaign for Uyghurs in 2017, when Chinese government was holding more than 1 million Uyghurs in the concentration camps, but I was not in the media, it's not being covered. Nobody was paying attention. The government was not really, people were not knowing exactly what was happening. That's why, since we founded the Campaign for Uyghurs, we have been advocating for the human rights and the democratic freedoms of the Uyghurs and the other Turkic people in East Turkestan. And since its inception, we have led actually the One Voice, One Step initiative in 2018, March and 2018. And it's actually a protest for the actions of the Chinese regime. And on the same day, 14 countries and 18 cities in the event, the protest lasted for more than 22 hours around the globe. And my sister and my aunt were abducted in September 2018. 6 days after I spoke publicly about the conditions of the camps and outlining the fate of my in-laws. Both of them are unusual targets. They are not famous. They are not educators, writers, or scholars. Neither has traveled to any of the foreign Muslim majority countries, and they both speak Chinese fluently. And these are some of the excuses why Uyghurs are sent to the camps. And my aunt was released a few months later, but it's almost 2 years now. The next month, it will be 2 years. There is absolutely no information on my sister's whereabouts. My sister, Dr. Gulshen Abbas, is a retired medical doctor, and she doesn't need any kind of vocational training. Therefore, I can firmly say here that her abduction is guilt by association. And they, my sister became the victim of CCP's reprisal for our activism here in America. And since then, I have quit my job in September last year, on 1 year anniversary of my sister's abduction, and I became a full-time advocate now. And our organization works closely with lawmakers, officials, academics, and the other grassroots organizations, and they raise awareness in the media, and we work to mobilize groups to take tangible actions against Chinese regime. And we have advocated raising a support for the Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act, as well as now asking support for the current Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act. And we are also involved in the congressional working groups, forums, and the international religious freedom platforms, and even giving recommendations to congressional committees and foreign government bodies, as well as US embassies in overseas about the plight of the Uyghurs. And in light of a COVID-19 pandemic now, we continue to maintain our activism through media, social media, and the online presentations. And we conduct advocacy efforts in multiple languages now, mainly concentrating in Turkish, Arabic, and the English, but as well as we have Spanish and also in Chinese as well. And however, prior to the pandemic, Campaign for Uyghurs actively attended conferences and religious forums, local, regional, and international forums, and sent its representatives to maximize the impact of its outreach and advocacy efforts. And this has effectively bolstered the Campaign for Uyghurs outreach, both in the public and the government spheres, and it created movement in the right direction, having China held accountable. Currently, and we released materials, actually the recent report entitled Genocide in East Turkestan, which is in English, Turkish, and we are working on Spanish and the Arabic version, which outlines the ways in which the brutal actions of the Chinese regime meet the conditions of genocide under the Geneva Convention on the Prevention and the Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, ratified in 1948. So since our organization places a high emphasis on the need for urgent action, and so we have been among the one of the first to use the word genocide since the beginning of last year. We already recognized that was active genocide. So there is no need to shy away from that because, if we wait for the aftermath to have the international community to declare in such as that will be, that would happen too late. It is genocide. 13 tons of Uyghurs here seized at the U.S. Customs and the Border Control recently. 13 tons of hair, just imagine that. This is a hardcore physical evidence of this genocide. So what else are we waiting for? My question is, images of the mass executions and gas chambers to be broadcasted by China? Already, there are news reports on the building of crematoria next to those concentration camps for this, for a culture and religion that doesn't practice cremation. So the never again is happening all over again, and we have a lot of work to do. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Hushanan, for that. And we'll come back to again some of the themes that you have highlighted. Dr. Anderson, at least if I may also request you maybe to tell us a little bit about in connection to your work, the work of Uyghur Human Rights Project. Your role in it, and the landscape within which you both operate.
Right, sure. Okay, I'll start with talking a little bit about UHRP, the Uyghur Human Rights Project. Awesome. I have been working at UHRP since December of last year, 2019. So not even a year yet, and it's been quite a year. But I specifically am working on projects dealing with human rights documentation, and research, and also capacity building for grassroots advocacy and for information verification and dissemination, evidence verification and dissemination. UHRP is a research-based advocacy organization. So we do research using primary and secondary sources on issues particularly pertaining to the human rights of Uyghurs with an eye toward impacting policy and also spurring on grassroots action, right, by just individual community members all across the United States and the world, and also civil society organizations and so forth. Up until really recently, UHRP was, which is based in Washington, D.C., I'm speaking to you from DC today. But up until recently, UHRP was mostly North America focused, although we've kind of started expanding who we're talking to and who we're in conversation with and collaborating with in more recent times. So we publish reports, we're talking full-length reports, 30, 40 or more pages in some cases, briefings, statements, and many other types of writing in mostly English and Chinese right now, although we're also expanding into other languages as well. And all of what we publish has an eye toward defending the civil, political, social, cultural and economic rights of Uyghurs and other people in the Uyghur homeland according to international human rights standards. And, you know, of course, that's just a very broad level explanation of what we do. If I got down to the nitty gritty of the day to day, it would be a lot, right? But again, our eye is always toward how can we impact policy and how can we also spur action from the grassroots to, you know, the highest levels of government and multilateral action. And just for a few examples of our recent reporting, we recently released a report on disinformation. So how is Chinese state media not just misinforming, but disinforming, you know, narratives and the broader conversation about what's happening to Uyghurs globally. We released a report about the city of Kashgar and the transformation it has undergone at the hands of the Chinese state, what that says about Uyghur life and the future for Uyghurs. We were involved in research on the Qarakash document or the Qarakash list, one of those leaked documents out of China that was released earlier this year. We've done work on the coronavirus situation for Uyghurs. We have a lot of ongoing research reports, a lot of ongoing research topics in process at any given moment. And in some ways that is, you know, very similar to my academic background and my academic work, which, like I said, has mostly focused on Uyghur cultural expression and Uyghur music. But that, of course, in a lot of ways ends up being relevant to what's happening now. You just heard Roshan say that kind of, you know, artists, cultural elite, the intellectual elite are in many ways targets of this campaign, you know, of what has been happening to Uyghurs. And I've certainly seen that impacting people I, you know, did my research with when I lived in the region and so forth. So there are very personal elements for me in some ways that are like a through line from my academic work to here, but also intellectual issues and questions about, and just human issues and human questions about rights and what does it mean to have the right to, you know, be who you are, speak the language you want, practice the culture you want to practice, or practice the religion that you want to practice. What does it mean to have those things taken away from you? So those are some of the through lines. But yeah, thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. So we'll move to our first question, which is also a question that, as you can see, has come from one of our audience members, Brother Muhammad Aziz, one of our mentors and leaders in the Devon area and the Devon Masjid. He asks, so what is the current situation? And again, if you were to imagine someone who may not be following the news very closely, but just hearing about the Uyghur crisis, what is life like for the Uyghur people in East Turkestan currently on a day-to-day basis? And a connected question to this is, how do you communicate with people on the ground, or are you not able to communicate with people on the ground? What are some ways to receive news from the field, given the restrictions that are imposed by the Chinese government?
I can just say I'll briefly mention about what is happening today. Let's talk about just regular people like you and me. I'm not talking about the ones in the camps, but just the daily lives for regular people. Anybody have read the George Orwell's 1984? That is basically the reality in East Turkestan today. Complete surveillance police state. And the China's waging a war on religion, basically. They are outlying everything, not just the religious, normal religious activities, but also our like Uyghur identity or any kind of the, you know, practicing your normal culture, using the Uyghur language, basically, and the everybody's forced to speak Chinese. The Uyghur women are forced to marry Han Chinese people, Uyghur girls, because if they say no to such a forced arranged marriage by the government, they are being labeled as refusing to marry non-Muslim Han Chinese. So So they, in fear of sending to the concentration camps, they are marrying to somebody who they don't love or they don't want to. So if a girl cannot choose who she wants to marry or who she doesn't want to marry, what do you call that? That is rape in the sham of marriage. And also 1.1 million Han Chinese cadres deployed to Uyghur homes to live inside of people's houses, to monitor and to supervise their daily lives. Most of the men are taken to either concentration camps or slave labor facilities or prisons. The women are subject to sexual abuse. So basically, the tragedy for the just regular people while their religion is being stigmatized and their ethnic identity is being demonized by the government. Everybody is living under fear. In the camps, intense indoctrination, forced mental and physical torture, and people are forced to forsake their religion and ethnic identity. In dehydrations and also not enough nutrition, and the very crowded rooms. We are seeing some of the pictures of so many people are crowded to one room. So not only China is waging a war on Islam, and they're also waging war on democracy and freedom. The information blockade, because of the information blockade, is extremely difficult to get any kind of information. And now, whatever is happening in East Turkestan, the tragedy of the Uyghurs is not just confined to us alone. And this will be the future of the entire world if China is not being stopped, because Beijing has infiltrated the Western universities and the UN and the NBA and the IOC and the Hollywood. In short, basically China is aiming to take down the democracy across the world. The consequences of failing to address this monstrous threat will be disastrous for humanity. And how we are getting the information, there are many people in the region who sent out very subtle videos and messages via Chinese social medias. And sometimes they are just jeopardizing their lives, their own safety, to send out some of the messages. And some others are leaking information, like Dr. Alice Anderson mentioned earlier, the Karkash documents and the 403 pages leaked documents. And they also, there is like another set of documents, which is the operating manuals for those camps. There are three sets of leaked documents, government's own documents. So they are not just something that I am saying as an activist or somebody else is saying from one of the Uyghur organizations. Those are hardcore evidence came from the Chinese government themselves. That's why there's still people, especially from some of the our Muslim brothers and sisters. Like I have been trying to convince this one person from Palestine origin in New York, living in the United States, still believing China's disinformation and false narratives. And he tells me, after all these documents, sending him all this information, he tells me that, China's not having any issue with religion. They are just fighting the radicalized Muslims among the Uyghurs. Mm-hmm. So, as I said, it's really difficult to get the information without risking the contact's life or their family members because of our knowledge of how China suppresses the information. When we do get the news or something, we can be certain that it's much worse and on a much larger scale than what it is being presented. Just recently talked to one of the former inmates who came out of the concentration camp living here in Virginia. Her husband was telling me that they lived there and they just came back last year. Mm-hmm. They were saying that, let me just finish with this. They were saying that everything we are saying here is only like 10% of what's actually being, what's happening. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. If I could jump in and just add or put some things in my own words, right? And add a little bit maybe. Mm-hmm. I think one big level way that's helpful, there's so much going on, right? And you just heard some of that it can feel dizzying and you think like, what, how does this all fit together? If you want to ask what life is like on the day to day, whether we're talking about someone who's in some form of detention or disappearance, or we're talking about people who are ostensibly free and on the outside, Uyghurs are living in a state of unfreedom no matter where they are and no matter, you know, inside or outside. There are, as I mentioned, there are various kinds of detention. So someone might be in a camp, in a temporary holding center known as a detention center. Mass internment is on the rise. Children are being put into state-run facilities in some cases. People are in forced labor schemes, et cetera. But there's so much surveillance on the outside. Recent reporting came from RFA's Uyghur service about apartment blocks that the authorities have moved formerly detained people into. So they're not even able to go back and live in their own home. They're living in a state-assigned apartment block, maybe in the county seat of whatever county they're from, right? Just levels and layers of unfreedom are shaping the contours of Uyghur life. And, you know, pervasive surveillance system, which bolsters all of this, you know, continues to loom over people's heads and over their lives. And that surveillance makes it difficult to communicate with people on the ground. But, you know, the authorities have tried to create an information vacuum. They haven't been 100% successful at that because some of the same technologies that they're using to oppress are also allowing things to get out, right? So we get one Uyghur advocate, his name is Arslan Hidayet, has likened some of the messages that people are risking themselves to send out to messages in a bottle. Right? People are just kind of throwing things out in the ocean, hoping they'll stick. So the things people post on social media have been, you know, from China have been very valuable in getting evidence out, as well as these higher level document leaks. But like on a personal level, I no longer have contact with my friends, my teachers, my classmates from the region, because it's simply too risky.
Question, if I may. Since the onset of the pandemic, have either of you felt a balancing act in, on the one hand, dealing with the COVID situation, and the other hand, not trying to fall into the anti-Chinese bigotry that has often been mouthed by the president? And I wonder if you feel that there's a balancing act that needs to be undertaken now so that one can still protest and act in solidarity with the Uyghur community, but not fall into the rhetoric used by this administration, which often uses China as a scapegoat.
That's a great question, and I think a really important one. And you posed it as a balancing act, and for me personally, I don't know if it even needs to be a balancing act so much as just an issue of consistency with seeing people as human across the board, and you know, seeing people as different from the governments that conscript them into things, or you know, rule over them, or shape the contours of their lives. I've had the privilege to read on Twitter and on, you know, news websites, you know, pieces by Chinese Americans and Chinese people in the US, you know, pointing out the ways that coronavirus and the way people speak about it are having negative impacts on them personally, harming their physical as well as emotional well-being. and safety. And so, you know, I think it's up to us to take that seriously. And again, be consistent with the values that we say we hold. And people and governments are not one and the same. And I think that can derive from our broader respect for human rights.
Thank you. Thank you, Elise, for that.
I just want to add this, you know, a little, my view to this is many people looking at this as like a political issue, but when you look, you know, what's happening to the Uyghur people and what the Chinese government is doing, and now mentioning about COVID-19, there is a credible report also we cannot verify, but there's a very good chance that the Chinese government is using Uyghurs as the guinea pigs, testing the vaccines on the Uyghurs now, locking down the entire city of Urumqi and the other parts. So this is not a political issue, political situation, but this is a human rights crisis that now developed into active genocide. The Chinese people are also became the victims of China's disinformation and the false narratives, just like most of our Muslim Ummah and the Muslim majority countries, and even those Muslim majority countries' governments and the leaders. The Chinese government is not telling them that they have concentration camps that they are running, and they are enslaving most of the Uyghurs and putting 3 million Uyghur people in the concentration camps because of their religion and their ethnic identity. They are lying to them. They are not only investing millions and billions of dollars in these countries to buy their silence and the compliances out, but also same time, they are spreading the disinformation about the actual situation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just sadly, this has been far from China's, you know, this is not the first time China is doing this, but China has used its new position of the economic powers to ramp up its persecution of the Uyghurs and Tibetans and Mongolians and what's happening in Hong Kong right now. And the other religious groups, all of them are becoming the victims of the Chinese Communist Party.
I think also, if I can add, I will be quick. Just we can see how so many of these major issues, the Uyghur issue on the one hand, and then the coronavirus as a global pandemic, are intimately linked. And you know, all the ways coronavirus is raging through the United States right now is intimately connected to this crisis. I'll say again, and you know, just one example of that is evidence we found that Uyghur forced laborers are likely making masks and other PPE. They are making masks and other PPE, and those things might be making their way to the United States for our own response to this coronavirus. And so I think, you know, this exposes a lot about the world, but and really is challenging us all with, you know, our response in some ways.
No, thank you to both of you. And I think this takes us to one of the questions that our audience can see when you click the Q&A button. As you can see, there are several questions that have come in and you have addressed some of them. But I think two questions address a specific point, which is what can we do here in the United States as Muslim Americans or as Muslims who live here in the United States? What are some ways that at the organizational level, at the individual level, one can help or learn from the Uyghur organizations? And of course, you know, connected to this is the ongoing Chinese propaganda, sometimes enlisting relatives of Uyghur leaders as well, as one of the questions from Andiaba Tang notes here. What are some ways, in other words, that again, an everyday person who is concerned, who is now informed, thanks to both of you about this crisis, can take? What are some resources that we can lead them to?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I can jump in because I'm looking at a list right now. Sure. Prepared a list to keep myself on topic and answering this question. So one way, a little bit of promotion. If you go to uhrp.org, we have a page on our website titled What You Can Do, which will provide you with some links and some suggestions. So keep that in mind, bookmark it for later. I'll also just go ahead and share. Definitely please ask your mosque and other organizations you're part of to endorse a global campaign for fashion brands to end complicity in Uyghur forced labor. You can ask your senator to co-sponsor the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act. You can donate to Uyghur organizations that are working on this cause and fighting for the Uyghur people, like Campaign for Uyghurs, like the Uyghur Human Rights Project, the World Uyghur Congress. We can really use your support in that way. Follow Uyghurs on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. They're telling their stories and sharing them widely. And there are also a lot of good petitions that are out there. So the UHRP What You Can Do page links to some of those. I could also send them to CARE to circulate if that's something people are interested in. Thank you.
So you'll be happy to circulate, Rishan. Thank you, Elise, for that answer. I've posted the link to the UHRP website.
Just to add to, those are really great points. Thanks, Alice. And I would like to also add the boycott Chinese goods and the companies who are profiting off silence on the Uyghur slave labor. When you see made in China, just remember those are made with Uyghur slave laborers. So try not to buy anything that's made in China and continue to raise awareness and speak to your legislators about those the bill that Alice just mentioned, and also there's another one, the Senator Hawley's anti-slavery bill is also a very important legislation that is a legislation that is connected to the Uyghur slave laborers, and we need to also a part of regarding to CCP's infiltrations in foreign universities, especially we've got all these Confucius Institutes everywhere in the United States. Now we just did recently, the US actually recognized them as a foreign mission, but that does not create enough of a precedent for the universities and forbid their operation because they renamed the universities renamed those Confucius Institutes now to like a culture and the language program or something like that. So that actually using our freedom and the platform here we have in America, spreading basically disinformation and the Chinese totalitarian ideologies. And also, CCP propaganda outlets like the Global Times Network and the other, there are some cable networks that people are paying to watch those CCP's propagandas. And we all should also initiate such as to boycott the 2022 Beijing Olympics, a country holding 3 million people because of their religion, because of their ethnicity and the background, and does not qualify to host Olympic Games. So there is a no right, no game hashtag to emphasize that allowing a genocidal regime like China should not be hosting Olympic Games. And also you can write to the IOC for that. And the plus, we should also support legislative efforts to hold the UN and the other entities accountable as well. China has been given a seat on the UN Human Rights Council panel. Can you imagine? China is on the UN Human Rights Council panel with upcoming votes on their appointment now recently, near future. We must call on countries to abstain from voting this appointment. We should also continue to pressure the organization, the Islamic Corporation, to act. The Ummah is desperately needed hosting awareness events like this one, and also encouraging imams to speak. Almost every Jummah prayer should include du'as and the raising awareness on this issue. The imams should step up, the most importantly, to share and to speak the truth regarding what's happening to the Uyghurs. And many powerful organizations like yourself and the individuals have been raising awareness, but also there are so many, the Muslim organizations has been silenced by China's money and the led astray by China's campaign of disinformation. Thank you.
No, thank you. And I know that this is exhausting, especially for both of you who are very close to the subject. Actually, on just the theme earlier today, one of the community members reached out to us saying that, hey, you're hosting this session on Zoom, but Zoom as a platform is also implicated in censoring and in canceling accounts of activists on the ground, which is, of course, another concern for us, and we appreciate that feedback. So I'm sure there are many others like this. I'm seeing one question from Brother Osama Al-Qasem, who is our CARE Pennsylvania board president, who asks, inviting us to take a step back, asking about the population of the Uyghurs, both in East Turkestan and also in the United States. And maybe this gives us an opportunity to talk a little bit about the Uyghur community here in the United States. What are some states where there is concentration of the Uyghur community? What are some ways that this community connects to one another? And also not only in the United States, but other parts of the globe as well.
The population of the Uyghurs always have been minimized by the Chinese regime. When the actual number was back in, years ago, like 30, 40 years ago, when it was 10 to 15 million, they always had like 6-7 million back then. And now the government official numbers say 12 million, but we know for a fact it's at least 20 to 25 million in East Turkestan. In the United States, there are about 8 to 10 million, I would say, living in the United States, and also Saudi Arabia, Central Asia, Europe, Australia, Turkey, Canada. In Turkey, we have the most population there. So altogether, I would say it's more than a million in the diaspora. Most of the people came to, if I just talk about the United States, when I first came over back in the late 1980s, the most Uyghurs were just coming as students, graduate students, so to come study here. And then the second wave was after the Gomja massacre in 1997, many Uyghurs arrived through Central Asia and Turkey. And then again, the second large wave was after 2009, Urumqi massacre. Many Uyghur young generations came over as students. In the early 2000, like between 2000 to 2010, many graduate students like PhDs and the people have master's degrees from Japan after they graduated, they moved over during those times. Population here in the United States, the Uyghur population varies. Just the many young students who really needs help, young generation here, and any kind of help from the communities. And also we have like well-known scientists and working in very respectful places.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's so hard to know those numbers, but fortunately the US Census, I'm forgetting the details of it now, but some of the census numbers that are taken in between, you know, the big census like we're doing this year, reveal things like self-reported first language spoken at home. And that has been very useful. So this figure of, maybe 8,000 to 10,000, maybe even more now, because those numbers are a little bit outdated. We know those figures from that self-reported first language at home information from the U.S. Census. And, you know, Uyghurs have been settling here and starting families, right? And that has helped that community to grow and flourish. You asked the question, Ahmed, of, you know, what state are they, or what area are they most settled in? And it's actually this area that Roshan and I are speaking to you from here in DC, that is the largest, it's kind of Uyghur land in the United States. So Virginia in particular, but also to some extent in DC and Maryland as well.
Absolutely. Many great Uyghur restaurants in that area. Maybe that also connects us, Elise, to a question that I wanted us to address, which is, how are the Uyghur people in general? What is the impact of, first of all, the repression and the oppression and the situation on the culture and the civilization and the transmission of these? And how are people who are in the diaspora keeping their traditions, their music, their cultural artifacts, and all of that alive while experiencing such harsh conditions at the same time?
Yeah, this is a heavy and large question that I hope I can do justice to. But you know, the situation for the survival of Uyghur culture feels really dire. You know, I last visited the region in 2018, and you know, I was heartened in some way to see that people were speaking the Uyghur language, but that doesn't mean it had a place left in, you know, formal institutional settings anymore, or that it really had, you know, a place left as a language of instruction and a language of production and so forth. And so, you know, based on the sort of, for me, I look at music a lot, right? And I can see that there's a much lower level of musical activity, and it's a different kind of musical activity that there has been before. And that, coupled with the erasure of Uyghur language from so many formal spaces and contexts, you know, means it's worrisome. We also heard about campaigns where, you know, books in the Uyghur language were taken away and burned, and a lot of bookstores were shut down. Bookstores that were still open barely had anything left when I visited in 2018. So it looks pretty dire in the region, from the best that we can tell. You know, in the diaspora, people have been establishing language schools, not just over the last few years. Those efforts have been going on for a long time among Uyghurs in Australia, across Europe, also here in the United States. People are forming ensembles. If you look at social media, you can actually find amazing, wonderful accounts across Twitter and Instagram and other places that celebrate Uyghur cuisine, Uyghur music, Uyghur dance, Uyghur culture. But you know, a lot of that is it's taking place in a completely separate social media ecosystem, right? And completely separate set of environments spread across the world, which creates some challenges. And these are efforts that people are making in their spare time from their full-time jobs, usually woefully underfunded. So those things present challenges at the same time that those efforts are absolutely important and doing a tremendous amount of good work.
Mm-hmm. And a connected question just came in the Q&A. And Rishana, please feel free to also address this, but I just wanted to highlight that question from Andy about Tang. A question about, you know, what are some ways to learn the Uyghur language in either different language programs or at the university level? Are there such programs that might help slow down the erasure of the language?
Alice can answer to that because, you know, she learned such a beautiful Uyghur, but let me just add to about the Uyghur culture and the heritage part. You know, what's happening in East Turkestan today is the communist Chinese government's version of the Holocaust final solution, basically. A high-level Chinese official, Hu Lianhe, said that the Uyghur problem must be taken to the final solution stage. And we are facing the complete extermination of our culture and the denial of our history and everything, actually, the heritage. To say this is a challenge is an understatement. Actually, we are facing genocide, and our bloodline is being bred out. Basically, the only aspect of our heritage is is allowed to be displayed are the false propaganda of the Uyghurs dancing in the rehearsed scenes or from those concentration camps, so-called, you know, re-education as vocational training centers, and also having Han Chinese people dancing around in the Uyghur clothes and the Uyghur dances on the streets, completely inauthentic and disgusting in their use, these beautiful culture to lie about the China's genocide. Everything that made the Uyghurs unique as our ethnic identity, our culture, our language, and our religion is being viewed as abnormalities by the Chinese government. Beijing's ambassador to US, Cui Tianqi, ambassador Cui Tianqi, he openly told CNN about 2 years ago. This was November 2018. If you Google CNN, you can see this, that by putting the Uyghurs into those so-called re-education centers, he said they want to make Uyghurs into normal persons. Imagine that. They looked at our culture and our religion and our, you know, history, everything that made us unique as abnormality, treated us as abnormal commodities. So what heritage will we have left unless if we start to act and take tangible action to stop this genocide?
Yeah, I think that's, thank you for adding that. And I think it's, you know, it's important to realize there are ways that Uyghur culture in the Uyghur homeland gets sort of taken away from Uyghurs and packaged in a certain way and put on display for the tourist gaze, for the sake of making money, for the sake of making it look like, oh, we're protecting this culture, right? We're preserving it. Those things very much do happen, and they're deeply misleading for people who don't know what they're looking at when they see it. And it's also, those sorts of things are deeply offensive to Uyghur culture and to people, you know, Uyghurs themselves, right, who love and want to practice this culture. To the question about language erasure or language loss here in the United States and elsewhere throughout the diaspora, I know that there are people who, there are efforts underway to create some more standardized curricula for the teaching of the Uyghur language, just to determine, you know, like, what should be the benchmark at this level? How do we, you know what benchmarks should even be there and how we're meeting them? So efforts are underway and people are talking with one another across, you know, different countries, across borders, to figure out what that looks like. And there are universities in the US that are still teaching the language. Indiana, Washington, Kansas, and Harvard, last I checked. Also University of Wisconsin, sometimes in the summer. So any or up to all of you could learn the Uyghur language if you were so interested. And then there are also the schools run primarily with, you know, Uyghur heritage speakers as their target.
Yeah. Wonderful. Thank you for that to both of you. We have one final question from Brother Osama. We'll get that, and I will get some closing remarks from you. And I'll ask it again, if you can guide us towards, you know, concrete action. We would be grateful for that. So the question is, are you seeing a growing support at the Senate and the Congress, the House, or is the Chinese hold/interest overriding the support for the Uyghurs?
I mean, I think the Uyghur issue is one of the very few issues that has managed to be bipartisan and to garner very wide bipartisan support throughout, you know, both sides of the U.S. Congress. Mm-hmm. So I don't see, you know, other things as overriding that support from the United States. Roshan, do you have anything to add?
I think you put it in very nicely. Yes, this is actually, as I mentioned, you know, it shouldn't be viewed as a political issue, and that's how it's being treated now. Both parties are really supporting. And we really hope to see, continue to, you know, see the both parties pushing forward on the taking the government and the administration to take tangible actions. And also not only United States, but when they are working with other same-minded, shared valued countries, all the Western democratic countries, it's there, everybody. Are being the first victim. Look at us. Just look at our today, and this is the future for the world, actually, especially the Muslim majority countries. We have direct stake because China is waging war on Islam. And the whatever they are doing to Uyghurs today, they are going to do that to all other Muslim majority countries, because any kind of original thought and the, anything that's above and beyond the Communist Party ideologies is threat to that totalitarian regime. And also, China's openly announcing to the world that they are rewriting the Holy Quran and the Bible, and the Vatican and the other the leaders from the Muslim world are being silent. Countries, short-term, you know, internal politics. Thank you.
Thank you so much for this. What I am doing, and sorry again about the connectivity issues here, is to post again the links to both organizations' websites, and at the same time to post the link to the Contest of the Fruits project at Haverford College. I want to give Jacob, if you want to, a few final words before we give the final floor to our panelists. But I wanted to do a shout out to Gang Xinhua again, to Brother Carmen Safir, one of our own board members who has been a passionate advocate on behalf of the Uyghur cause in Philadelphia and beyond, and his wife, Sister Rukaya, as well. They've spent many hours in the masajid in areas as our elder African-American, one of the founders of CARE Philadelphia, Brother Carlin. And I wanted to thank him again for his efforts. I think what we'll do is, Jacob, if you can, kindly say a few words, and then I'm seeing one question I can't ask this that just came in, is which is that, does the Uyghur Human Rights Bill, is it helpful for Uyghur asylum seekers? So that's the question. So is in your closing remarks, if you can highlight this after Jacob says a few words, we'll appreciate it, and then we'll wrap up our program.
Thank you, Ahmed. Thank you to Roshan and Elise. It's been a pleasure listening to you. Sometimes, although the report is sad, people hearing this can be motivated to address the situation. And that's one of the reasons that CARE does webinars like this. Even though they're foreign issues and we are still primarily a domestic organization, we feel connected both being a part of the Ummah, worldwide Muslim community, but also because we feel that any persecuted people should be our responsibility, and that silence or turning one's head is not an avenue to address evil or persecution. The evils that we see in the world can only be addressed by activism and courage, which the two of you have brought to us in abundance. So we thank you again. We hope you will come back in better times to report more about the situation of the Uyghur in China and also in the diaspora. So again, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jacob
and the CARE for putting this panel together. Yes, this pandemic created a lot of challenges for our advocacy work, but we are continuing to do giving us this opportunity. And when I talk about this pandemic, I want to quickly also address this, the pandemic, which the CCP deliberately suppressed the information and punishing the whistleblowers and the creating this epidemic from one city to now this global pandemic. This should be a wake-up call. A country that can unleash this on to the world with no remorse, and who can lie about something like this. And now today, more than over 20 million people are infected and it caused more than 750,000 deaths in the world today, cannot be trusted on any level. The Americans are quick to find fault with our own country, and the you know, there are a lot going on, but that is a good thing. It means that we can self-criticize and improve our system. But when people have the naive assumption of that our system, while it's not perfect, but somehow worse than China's communist system, well, that type of thinking is disastrous for our future. It's harmful to the advocacy work. We are getting attacked right and left from people. When I see the Americans, actually some of the Americans are defending Chinese system using our freedom platforms here, it just worries me for the future of our world. And our faith, Islam teaches us that we are all will be asked at the end, what did we do when we knew it? We need to act in accordance with our humanity and our conscience, because this, what's happening to Uyghurs today, is a test for the conscience of the world. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for those remarks. I put a link rundown of what the act does provide provision for. You could see that in the one pager on the UHRP website that I linked to. And just know that there are organizations and people working pretty tirelessly to try to find protections and provide protections for Uyghur asylum seekers. And that maybe segues nicely into the closing comment I want to make, which is just that it's very easy for a variety of reasons to forget about Uyghurs and to forget about the human aspect of this whole thing we're even talking about in the first place. There are Uyghurs across the world who are experiencing an unimaginable loss. To most of us, it's unimaginable. Other Uyghurs themselves are living it. And we need to listen to their voices and put them back at the center of this, right? So it is up to us. We can listen, we can act in empathy, we can center and recenter and amplify those voices. Uyghurs have been risking their lives, risking their emotional well-being to practically scream at the world. And so, you know, I urge all of you and all of us to listen and really give a place of importance to those voices. Thank you.
Wonderful. We are grateful to you both for your wonderful remarks, for your expertise. Again, please check out the chat. And it's a testament that this has been one of our best attended webinars so far with such interaction, despite the fact that we couldn't go live on Facebook. But we will definitely post the video recording there. Again, thank you to all of you. Thank you to many of the local Uyghur leaders, Robert Asim here in Allentown, to Dr. Rashad and many others here in this area for keeping us alive. I want to give a shout out to two programs that are coming up. One is part of the Haverford College's Contest of the Fruits project, together with Gangshan, with 12 Gates Art, CARE Philadelphia and Haverford College. We are having an Uyghur poetry session at the end of August. So please be on the look for that. that many Uyghur leaders, Uyghur poets, and then many others will be featured. And a second program is next week. We are hosting another webinar, this time on the Kashmir crisis and the situation there with Hafsa Kanjwal from Lafayette College and with Dr. Sabina Fazli from Philadelphia, Kashmir American advocate and poet. So again, thank you, Rushan Abbas of Campaign for Uyghurs. Thank you, Elise Anderson, Dr. Anderson of Uyghur Human Rights Project for this. Thank you to all of you for joining us. We'll definitely make sure to amplify and uplift the Uyghur cause and activism around it. Have a great evening.
Thank you so much. Thanks. Thank you. Bye to all.
Bye-bye.